Telemetry News Now.
Welcome to another episode of Telemetry News Now. Very exciting because here in upstate New York, we are finally in nice weather. I feel like I talk about the weather and our progress in our corner of the world every other week, Justin. I don't know. But we are in the 60s and 70s, though we're getting a lot of rain. But I am very happy to see no snow and constant blanket of gray clouds over my head all the time. So how is it by you?
I am actually in Chicago this week. I'm attending Shinog on Thursday, which will talk a little bit more about in the events section, but man, is it beautiful in Chicago. This is like the perfect time if anybody ever wants to go visit Chicago. I was walking around with my coworkers yesterday, 70 degrees, sunny, it's beautiful here. So definitely having a good week from that perspective.
Yeah, yeah. One negative about this time of year where I live is that we have black flies in the area, which are very, very tiny. So, you know, you think that they weren't that big of a deal, but they are, and they'll leave welts on you. And especially as you go farther north into the Adirondacks, they can swarm around you and leave you just covered, and it's difficult. So you see folks with like bug nets over their head and stuff. But the weather itself, fantastic. You can't beat like May and September in my part of the world. So let's just jump into the headlines for today. We have a few interesting things, including some stuff directly about the future of the internet. But first, from TechCrunch on May 13th. Google announced that its generative AI assistant Gemini, probably already familiar with that, will roll out over the next few months to every single vehicle running Android Auto, and then later this year to cars with Google's built-in operating system. So the idea here is that this is going to promise more natural conversational voice control, proactive route-aware recommendations, that sounds interesting, like restaurant searches and that stuff, of course, and an always-listening Gemini Live mode for full-fledged dialogues. I don't know if you've ever used the ChatGPT dialogue thing on your phone or any other app, Justin, but I use that quite a bit. So everything is going to be processed in the cloud until future models, I don't know what the timeline is there, gain enough onboard computing for edge inference. So right now we're not running anything heavily locally in the car for now. Now, Google claims that this upgrade will reduce driver cognitive load. That's what Google is claiming. It's going to reduce driver cognitive load while supporting more than 40 languages and extending to all markets where Gemini is already available. I'm not sure this will, I don't know if this is going to increase or decrease distraction for drivers and thereby cognitive load. I mean, on one hand, it's a conversation, right? We already have conversations with folks over the phone or with somebody else in the car.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it never really works out that smoothly when we're working with technology. And then I get frustrated and I got to tap on the screen to kill it or this or that. And, you know, the session doesn't work. It doesn't understand me. I get frustrated, you know. So as far as reducing cognitive load, I'm not sure about that. And I like the idea, though, the conversational interface, if it was perfected, that I can see being very productive. I don't know. What do you think, Justin?
You know, I'm not a Android audio guy or auto guy. I'm a CarPlay guy, but I love CarPlay in the car. But I was talking to my sister-in-law about this recently, actually, how it can be very distracting if you're doing it all on the touchscreen, right? You're interacting with it on the touchscreen in your vehicle instead of having your eyes on the road.
Mm-hmm.
So I've started over the last few months trying to get in the habit of doing the Siri interface in CarPlay to interact using natural language, right?
Mm-hmm. And yeah.
It's not perfect, but it is less distracting because you can, in natural language, say, hey, you know, give me the directions to this place that I'm going, or search for the nearest gas station, or search for an article talks about taco places with vegan options near me, right? Like, so you can give it some additional prompting, and it works relatively well. Like any other technology, like you're saying, it's not perfect. Sometimes she comes back and says, I can't do that right now.
But yeah, and it'll improve over time, right? Of course, I get it.
Yeah. You know, the other thing I thought was interesting here is, I guess I just sort of assumed that they were already doing some amount of AI with the way their Android Auto worked. You could speak to it previously, I think, right? So I guess they were just doing the front end or LLMs to translate your voice to text and then doing a simple search. What they're adding now, it looks like, is the ability to actually do more complex AI queries instead of just a simple Google search. Is that what you take away from this?
You know, I don't know exactly what's on the back end, but I mean, there are things like semantic routers that really, they're explicitly programmed with words and phrases. So they're not ultra sophisticated, but I mean, they're sophisticated in the sense that they can hear your voice and translate it to, you know, an action. So there are those things out there that have been around for a while. And then natural language processing before large language models, you know, we still had that in confined domains. So in a question answer kind of a thing. And then now, like you said, on the back end, being able to call other functions like looking up restaurants and, you know, maybe interacting with our personal stuff, like what's on my calendar for today, you know, so we can do more with that today, which I think is really neat. I just don't know if it's going to decrease or reduce driver cognitive load, like Google says. You know, you're still doing the same kind of activities, but instead of tapping on the screen, you know, the idea I think here is going to reduce distractions and do it using natural language via voice, you know. So, yeah, anyway, from SDX Central a few days ago on May 8th, Cisco's OutShift Incubator just announced a prototype quantum network entanglement chip created along with UC Santa Barbara that produces up to 1 million high-fidelity entangled photon pairs per output channel, or 200 million pairs per second across the chip, while running at room temperature on standard telecom wavelengths. So that last part is very important. So the process consumes less than 1 milliwatt of power, and the chip fits into existing photonic integrated circuits. Now, I did a little bit more research than usual for this headline because I'm not a physicist, so bear with me here. The idea is that the chip can ride today's fiber infrastructure, cabling infrastructure, to, quote, teleport quantum states between distant nodes, which in theory would form the basis of a very scalable quantum internet using currently deployed cabling. Folks, we are talking about quantum entanglement here on Telemetry Now. I never thought we would be doing that, Justin, but we are.
Yeah, I'm learning all kinds of new stuff today.
Yeah, but it is networking, so it's interesting. So anyway, to make this happen, Cisco opened a dedicated quantum networking lab in Santa Monica to refine the chip and develop complementary pieces like entanglement distribution protocols, a distributed quantum compiler, a quantum network development kit, and a vacuum noise quantum random number generator. To be fair, I don't know what any of those things are, but wow, you know, we are talking about, you know, looking at a new way to do the internet. So executives say integrating both hardware and software in-house, in this case for this project, could bring the timelines that they're thinking for this quantum internet down from decades, many decades, to maybe even 5 to 10 years, which is amazing. So, you know, what's also interesting here is that when I did, you know, some research around this headline to dig deeper and learn a little bit about it, I found articles going back more than a year from other sources like the University of Chicago, Northwestern, Microsoft, talking about the potential and experimentation around this, a quantum internet, and also using current cabling, you know, so fiber optics that are already out there. So it's definitely, to me at least, very, very interesting development and very interesting as far as a direction that we're going in the networking industry.
So if I understand this correctly, Phil, you were educating me a little bit before we started recording. The concept is that the state on one end is instantaneously changed on the other end. Like they're basically entangled, linked together. So if you change the state on one end, it instantaneously changes it on the other end. So instead of the traditional fiber optic transport systems where optical systems where you transmit light across a fiber optic from one end to the other to signal data being transmitted. In this case, you're connecting through quantum and entanglement on either side, and you change one side, it instantaneously changes it on the other side across a long distance. Is that basics of what we're talking about here?
Are you asking me to explain quantum entanglement to you, Justin?
Yes.
I don't think I can do that. You got the gist of it, is that, you know, that two particles in the universe are linked together in such a way, to me it's magic, where you change the state of one, or you even observe the state of one, you can observe, therefore understand the state of the other, or change the state of one and then change the state of the other, regardless of distance, which is this idea of a quantum network, where you can change the state of a particle and then instantaneously have it change on the other side. Thereby, if you use that as your underlying mechanism, somehow transmit data using that, in ways that are, I assume, faster and more efficient than we have now. One is that we are not dealing with the speed of light as a factor. And two, I don't know how that's going to play into things like, you know, like you mentioned earlier before we started the recording, things like latency or what does throughput actually look like? And I get it. So we're now faster than light, or light isn't a factor. But how much throughput do we actually have? I don't know. I don't know those things. But obviously, this is what Cisco and all these other researchers that we mentioned are doing, University of Chicago, you know, and big names like that in academia. They're researching this stuff. So we'll see we'll see some news, I assume, over the next, you know, 5 years to 10 years, like they said. So very exciting, very interesting.
You have to take a pause from reading about the latest AI models and learn a little bit more about quantum physics.
Yeah, right. That's true. And to be fair, I watch some of those things at like 11 o'clock at night when I'm having my midnight snack or almost midnight snack and sitting there on YouTube having a sandwich, watching like the latest YouTube video of stuff that like, oh, yeah, string theory. I know all about that. Yeah. So it's interesting to me in that sense, but also because we could be talking about a new type of internet that obviously would change the world, in my opinion, like the first internet did, or the current internet, I should say, right?
Did you ever watch Quantum Leap, the show where the guy would like go back in time to fix, you know, a crime or something, or right a wrong or whatever?
Yeah, Scott Bakula.
Like, when they started talking about quantum teleportation, that was what came up in my mind, was episodes of that show where he's jumping through time.
Oh, yeah, I remember that show when I was a kid, for sure. Okay, so this next headline from TechCrunch on May 13th, isn't necessarily networking. It's actually not really even tech, I guess, in the sense of tech that we typically talk about on this show. But I'm bringing it up mostly because I use these kinds of AI meeting transcription tools all the time. I think, Justin, you probably do as well, and we have them here at work. Mm-hmm. So from TechCrunch, Notion has entered the kind of crowded AI meeting transcription space. And so that's alongside Zoom, ClickUp, Otter, and others by introducing an AI-powered note-taking tool that records system audio on the Mac desktop app. It also generates live transcripts, very useful, lets users add manual notes in parallel, and then produces a formatted summary for, you know, whatever, sales calls, stand-ups, technical calls, whatever you're doing, meetings, in more than a dozen languages, which is interesting. So Notion's new feature requires participant consent, and it'll soon be available on mobile as well. So according to Notion, this complements new enterprise offerings like cross-app search, research mode. It sort of signals Notion's push to become a more full production or productivity suite, right? Competing with Google and Microsoft. Now, I use Notion. Mm-hmm. I also use Otter quite a bit. And, you know, at first I sort of resisted some of these tools, especially because I saw they were kind of the AI transcription generation function. That's what I'm talking about specifically. But I really changed my mind, and now I kind of rely on them quite a bit, especially for technical calls. Or if I'm not able to attend a meeting, you know, I'll make sure somebody please do the transcript thing, not just record it, and I can browse the transcript if I want, as opposed to listening to the audio. So I don't know. I think it's good news from Notion, of course, assuming that they do well in terms of accuracy. That was an issue for me in the early days, right? Mm-hmm. That's why I was resistant. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's gotten much, much better.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Being on the sales side of the house here at Kintiq, we use Gong for all of our external meetings with partners and customers and so forth. And it is amazing. It's gotten much better. Like you said, the transcripts are much more accurate. It summarizes it. So not only do you get the actual transcript, but it'll give you a summary of like, okay, there was a 30-minute call. Here's the high points of the conversation. Here's the next steps. It'll even help, in Gong's case, and I assume this is where Notion's going with this, it'll even help draft a follow-up email.
Interesting.
You know, if you met with a customer and you owe them, you know, a response to something that was discussed, it'll actually even prompt you with like, hey, here's the draft of the email that you should send them as a follow-up. So it is amazing how these tools are helping us be more efficient with our time and not forget stuff that we need to be doing as far as follow-ups and stuff. But I'm with you. Like when I first started using them, Phil, like having every single call we do with a customer be recorded just seemed a little like big brother-ish to me. But, you know, I'm willing to get over that because of the efficiency that it brings in having it. So it is nice to have it and be able to go back and reference either the recording or the AI audio transcript of stuff if you're trying to remember like what took place in a meeting 3 months ago.
Yep, agree. Okay, from the Cisco newsroom, Cisco announced that it recently joined an organization, actually, I guess you can more accurately call it an investment consortium. It's been around for a little while, called the AI Infrastructure Partnership, or AIP. Now, you're going to find the same headline in Network World, the BlackRock website, other sources as well. Now, AIP, this is the investment group I'm talking about, was originally formed late last year. It's led by BlackRock, Global Infrastructure Partners, MGX, Microsoft, NVIDIA, XAI. And according to these groups, it brings its networking and security expertise to help build a secure, scalable, open architecture platform for next generation AI data centers. So the plan of the group is to unlock something like $30 billion in equity commitments, and with debt financing and that sort of thing, mobilize another $100 billion to fund hardware, software, energy, and the connectivity needed to support these large-scale AI workloads. And, you know, we've been talking about that quite a bit, Justin, the sheer cost the scale of these data centers require that kind of investment, and there is no letting up. The foot seems to be, you know, on the gas right now. Cisco's CEO, Chuck Robbins, many of our listeners familiar with Chuck Robbins, and also BlackRock's Larry Fink, highlighted the economic potential of AI. I think we all understand that, but also the critical role cross-industry collaboration is going to play in realizing that potential, which is interesting because we are seeing development and collaboration among private industry, government, multiple vendors that you'd think might even be competing with each other, not necessarily in this case. So now I do have a statement from Cisco. Quote, the addition of Cisco reinforces AIP's commitment to an open architecture platform and fostering a broad ecosystem that supports a diverse range of partners on a non-exclusive basis, all working together to build a new kind of AI infrastructure. I don't know. I feel like this is kind of like the regular cadence of AI investment news that we talk about all the time, you know? I mean, we see it all the time today in today's tech world. So, but these really are huge dollar amounts. They're huge investments. And we're talking about giant companies, BlackRock, Microsoft, NVIDIA.
I mean, I think the partnership is interesting to know about and to keep an eye on to see what comes out of it, right? What actually comes of this investment? But the articles are a little light on like, what exactly are they going to do with this money? Other than obviously it's AI.
But like, I agree. I noticed that. Yeah.
All right. Moving right along. The next article is from PC Magazine talking about some news around Starlink. Phil, we've covered Starlink quite a few times on the podcast here, but this one specifically, they got approval from the FAA to move the number of launches they're allowed to do in a calendar year from 5 up to 25 per year. And why that's important is as they need to launch more rockets to put more satellites up into space, being constrained with only being able to do 5 per year really limits what they can do. And especially they've had some issues here with a couple of the last ones where they've exploded in the atmosphere and they've had, you know, launch problems, that kind of stuff. So the 5 per year, as they start to scale out their business, was becoming quite a constraint. So they've gotten approval, as I said, from the FAA, go up to 25 per year. This is now, of course, launching these from their new city that they renamed Starbase Texas, right, where they're doing their launches from. Mm-hmm. So I thought that part was interesting. The other thing I thought was really interesting from the article is they talked about their new V3 Starlink satellites. So satellites that they're actually planning to launch going forward are much more powerful than the V2 that they've launched to date. The ones they've launched to date, they call V2 mini satellites. So the V3... each satellite provides 1 terabit of downlink speed and 160 gig of uplink capacity speed, which is 10 times the downlink and 24 times the uplink capacity of the current generation V2 mini satellites. So even just the improvement in the generation of satellite, not to mention having a lot more of them up there, is going to increase the capacity that Starlink has on their network. And the article hints at they might be able to start offering 1 gigabit per second speeds to presumably customers. And we've talked a little bit about some of the now transit that they're able to provide with some of their new base stations. So, yeah, more coming from SpaceX and Starlink for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, gigabit speed, low latency speed via satellites, phenomenal. You know, I did see that these V3 satellites are much bulkier, weighing over 2 tons. So these are, you know, much bigger and bulkier and heavier than the V2 satellites. So that's going to require obviously more investment to get into orbit and the use of the bigger Starship, obviously, which is, you know, more fuel, more cost and everything. So it's not a trivial matter. I'm really excited about the potential of having gigabit speed, you know, via satellite, right? That's phenomenal. It's amazing. But what do you personally think about the sheer number of small satellites now that we're seeing in these meshes in orbit? You know, I have to assume with, you know, good faith and grace given to the FAA that they know what they're doing and that we're not going to have these incredible adverse effects of having a crowded low Earth orbit.
Yeah.
Since they approved this.
I mean,
I don't know.
I'm not really sure. The article didn't talk about that portion of it. It did talk that they had done a study on the impact of the environment from, you know, obviously when a rocket launches, it puts off exhaust and fumes into the atmosphere forth. So they had done a study and didn't feel like it was going to have a material negative impact on our environment from allowing these additional launches. So that part they did do some research on. The article didn't really say whether they did the research on the space debris impact of this. But I mean, that is something I think is more of this because keep in mind, it's not just Starlink that's launching these, right? Amazon's got their own thing. And I read an article recently that Apple's starting to do their own offering too, right? And I'm sure Google's probably got one, right? So we're going to have multiple competing companies that are launching rockets into space to do internet via satellite. So yeah, to your point, you're going to start having collisions in space. You're going to start having these things that they lose contact with and are abandoned. I don't know, Phil, if you saw the articles here recently in the last week or so where they had a, I think it was a Russian rocket that like they had lost connectivity to in like the 1980s, maybe, that recently fell and landed in, I think, in the Indian Ocean. A lot of it burned up as re-entered the atmosphere, but it landed in the Indian Ocean. But for about 24 hours, they were really nervous about where that was actually going to land as it came into the Earth's atmosphere. So, yeah.
Yeah, and this is not around the corner, folks. We're not going to have gigabit satellite connectivity next week. So far, you know, the test flights with Starship, because remember, that's much bigger than Falcon, and they're using dummy payloads right now to test this out. They're not successful so far. The upper stages have exploded in the most recent two test flights, so it'll be a little bit of time. But one thing I do give to SpaceX and the Starlink as well is just they keep pushing. Some people decry like, oh, there was a rocket explosion. Everything has to stop now. And they just keep pushing. They understand that there are these kind of faults. We're not talking about human casualties
here. There's nobody on these things, from no humans on there. So it's not impacting human life.
But they do keep pushing. And so
I will say, though, you know, got a personal story here. My wife and I, especially when the weather's nice, like we were talking about at the top of the show, like to go out and go, I'll call it glamping. Got a nice big camper that we take out and go out to a state park and spend the weekend. Well, historically, I've had the only internet connectivity I had was on my hotspotting on my cell phone, right? And a lot of these campgrounds get no cell phone signal. So you're off the grid, which is nice.
Yeah.
But then it limits the amount of time I can go. I have to wait till my work week is over to be able to go out and spend the weekend out camping. So I went ahead and bought a Starlink setup and took it out this past weekend, my wife and I did, to a state park here in Missouri. And I was getting about 160 meg down and about 18 meg up set up at the campground, and was able to actually do my work day on Friday. So we could go out Thursday night. My wife and my daughter could run around and do some hiking, do whatever they wanted to do, while I did a little bit of work on Friday to wrap up the work week. So it's definitely, you know, unlocked a little bit more flexibility in my work-life balance by being able to do that. So
yeah. And then with the advent of gigabit connectivity, it'll just, you know, make it that much more flexible and mobile as far as our digital workforce, right?
For sure. All right. The next headline is from, actually the next two headlines are from US News. The first one talking about NVIDIA sending 18,000 AI chips to Saudi Arabia. So if any of our listeners follow politics, you probably are aware that Trump recently visited the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, over in Saudi Arabia. And one of the things that apparently they talked about was that the Saudi Arabian Sovereign Wealth Fund, so that's the national government of Saudi Arabia's investment fund that they run and own, has a company in their portfolio, an AI startup called Humain, I believe it's pronounced, H-U-M-A-I-N, Humain, who wants to get their hands on some AI chips because, like a lot of companies and countries, they're looking to build out data centers that have GPUs in them. And so NVIDIA has committed to send 18,000 chips to Saudi Arabia to Humain so that they can build their data center and do presumably AI, you know, workload training. They're going to be sending them the GB300 Blackwell chips, which are some of NVIDIA's newest chips, some of their most advanced chips. So they're apparently building a 500 megawatt data center there in Saudi Arabia that they'll be installing these NVIDIA GPU chips in.
Yeah, it also does speak to the friendliness that the United States has with the Middle Eastern countries for sure right now. We're seeing that. And of course, there's an incredible amount of wealth and influence in the Middle East, which which makes it certainly tactical to be friendly and to have these kinds of investments. NVIDIA in particular, I mean, we're talking about the investment in a single data center, like you said, a 500 megawatt data center. So who operates this data center? We understand the company, but we also, you know, we know, you and I talking, that there are specific models that can be trained and built, and like, what's the purpose and what's the goal? Is it, you know, AI is a very broad, ambiguous term. And so that's what I'm interested to see, is what the actual nation of Saudi Arabia is interested in doing. Now, it could be that it is just, we need to get on this bandwagon and support the activity where we can be cutting edge technologically and keep pace with the United States and China. Or there may be a very specific AI application that we are looking at that, you know, presumably behind the scenes, the United States, NVIDIA, and others are, whether wittingly or unwittingly, supporting.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, you know, Jensen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA, was quoted in the article saying AI, like electricity and internet, is essential infrastructure for every nation. Right. Yeah. To your point, we don't know exactly what their nation is going to use it. Are they going to use it to advance medical research? Are they going to use it for coming up with better attack vectors for, you know, defending their own country in case of a digital war? Who knows? It's hard to tell. I mean, probably all of those are within bounds of what they have planned. But
sure.
Yeah.
And to call AI electricity, like a commodity like electricity, a thing that, you know, at first when electricity was a thing where, I mean, it's not like we invented it, but when we were able to harness its power and move it and store it and those kind of things over the, you know, the Industrial Revolution and forward, it eventually became one of those things where it's like a commodity for all people. It's not a luxury item. And then, you know, we started to talk about that with regard to the internet not that long ago, if you remember, just a generation ago, really, maybe a couple decades ago, where we said, like, is the internet that same kind of a thing, like municipal water and electricity going into every home and everybody just needs it as a matter of a, maybe not necessarily a right, but like a basis, you know, for our society. I think
COVID taught us that the internet's pretty critical to, you know, interacting and collaborating with one another, sure. Especially when there's a pandemic like COVID.
Yeah, but Jensen said AI, he put AI in that category as well, artificial intelligence. You know, that's, I don't know. I haven't really thought about AI in those terms yet specifically.
Yeah, it's very forward leaning for sure. But I, you know, I can see where, you know, as we get more and more reliant on some of these things we've been talking about on the podcast, whether it's Notion, call recording, we get more and more reliant on some of these things. It may become where it's like really hard to live, to do your day-to-day function without access to our AI tool set.
Well, I mean, it's
sad as that kind of sounds. How did we function without
it? It's going to be hard to function in the context that we've built. I mean, you can drop out, man. You could go live in a tiny home in the Alaskan wilderness and live off the land, like that show that my family and I watch. We love watching, what is it called? The Alaska, whatever. Anyway.
Off the grid?
Yeah, well, they live off the grid, but that's not the name.
There are definitely some days where that seems really appealing.
Life below zero. That's what it is. Anyway, yeah, you could do that. And there's probably a lot of people that are seeing these kind of things that are more inspired to do that more than ever. And to be fair, I am as well. Like I live in a typical American suburb and I work in tech, so I won't be doing that anytime soon. But I got to admit, I think about it once in a while. I'm like, am I relying on this technology and just to live in this world? And then I think about how I love science fiction, right? And I love Star Trek. And yeah, you know, in those shows, it's fiction. I get it. But they had to rely on that technology in order to function in that society, in that societal context. So interesting.
All right. Moving on to our final article for day, kind of ending on a little bit of a down note, but we'll get through it. Microsoft announced they are going to be laying off about 6,000 workers on Tuesday. I guess, let me look at the date of this article. This article was May 13th. So presumably that was yesterday that these layoffs were announced. Nearly 3% of its entire workforce. So Microsoft is, I think as of last June, the last time they announced their number of headcount, they had 228,000 full-time workers. So 6,000, maybe roughly 3% of their workforce. And they did say this is the largest job cut that they've done in more than 2 years. And the reason that they're doing this is that they are spending more heavily on artificial intelligence. So now, on the surface, this could be seen as, oh, AI is taking our jobs, but I don't think it's really that. The more I read the article, Phil, I think it's more that where they're going with their business, where they're investing heavily, obviously, is in, you know, a lot of the AI stuff that they're doing, a lot of the models they're training. They're an investor, obviously, in OpenAI. If they're going to take their money and invest it in a lot of this AI stuff, some of the things they were previously doing, they're obviously investing less in, and the staff that they have weren't working on some of the newer stuff. Makes sense to let those folks go, and presumably they're going to have to hire in other areas to build more of these AI tool chains and training and models and so forth that they're investing more heavily in.
Yeah, yeah. I have pretty much rejected the idea that AI is going to take everybody's jobs, especially in software development and things like that. We've talked about it several times on the show. You know that I use like KingCursor. It's just awesome, like, to have that as my co-pilot. I'm sorry to use that word, but it is a good word. Mm-hmm. As I'm, you know, typing up something, to, you know, some code to make a workflow work. I mean, it's awesome. And then, of course, the other tools that I use, and I'm very much embedded in the AI, especially AI for network operations space right now. So I don't see it taking people's jobs. And in this case, though, you know, these large companies have these reductions in force from time to time for various reasons, whether they be tied directly to economic trends or to a shift in the focus of the company. In this case, that's what your theory is. And I get that. The last one was really big 2 years ago in 2023. I mean, they eliminated, about 10,000 jobs. So
yeah, 5%.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, not related to performance is what Microsoft is saying. So we get it, reducing layers of management. That makes sense. I get it. And maybe shifting the focus of the company for the next few years. So it is certainly sad. You know, we know folks that work at Microsoft, but unfortunately, these things do happen, especially in the larger companies. We do hear from it about these kind of things from time to time. So, you know, I hope those folks that were laid off land somewhere quick, and it is a minimal impact, and even provides some new opportunity that they didn't even expect.
Absolutely. All right, that's it for the headlines for this week. Let's talk a little bit about upcoming events. Like I said earlier in the show, I'm in Chicago this week. Tomorrow, May 15th, as we're recording this, is the Chicago Nog, Shinog, that's put on roughly every year. I think they missed a year last year, so I'm excited to see this one come back. Agenda looks really good, as always, that's put together by the organizer, so I'm looking forward to attending that tomorrow and learning about some of the newer trends in networking. Next up on our radar is AutoCon 3, put on by the Network Automation Forum. That's in Prague, May 26th through 30th. Myself and a few of my colleagues here from Kintiq will be putting on a workshop. So we're excited to teach folks who want to sit through that a little bit more about network observability and what we now at Kintiq are calling network intelligence. We'll be talking a little bit about why we're calling it that and then walking through some basics on setting up a tool set to collect some network telemetry. So if you're going to AutoCon 3 in Prague and going to the workshops but haven't picked out which workshop you're doing on Monday afternoon, we would be honored to have you sit through our session. But you'll definitely learn something from AutoCon. Phil, I know you and I both have been to a number of these, and they're always well done. I always learn something, and I think you do as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Next up after that, I guess it's actually before that, chronologically, is Vermont Nug in Essex Junction, Vermont. That is coming up on May 21st. So if you're in that area, definitely check that out. Illinois Nug in Chicago on June 5th. So if you're in the Chicagoland area, but you can't make Shinog on May 15th, go check out the Illinois Nug on June 5th. That'll be an afternoon evening thing. And then that same day, if you're in the St. Louis area on June 5th, there is a Missouri Nug. I'm one of the organizers of that. So I can tell you, we're doing our best to make that a good use of time. We have a friend of the show, Scott Robon, who's going to come talk about total network operations as the keynote for that Missouri Nug on June 5th. So if you're in the area, come check that out.
Awesome. Thanks very much, Justin. So with that, those are the headlines for today. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.